Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emeritus at Simmons College, who assesses the escalating violence between Israelis and Palestinians following several attacks by suicide bombers, which killed more than 24 people inside Israel. Kurt Goring of Amnesty International USA, who explains why his group opposes a Bush administration anti-terrorist measure that proposes to lift restrictions on government surveillance of domestic, political, and religious groups. And a report on last month's demonstrations at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, where protesters accused the school of training terrorists. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While U.S. President George Bush pledged global leadership on the war against terrorism at his well-received speech at the United Nations on November the 10th, the reach of multinational initiatives clearly has its limits. As Bush was speaking at the UN, American diplomats were in Morocco sitting on their hands at the UN conference to finalize the details of the Kyoto Agreement on global warming. According to The Nation magazine, there is alarming evidence that recent increases in global temperatures have led to melting glaciers and to increasing numbers of severe storms. The UN Environmental Programme is predicting a rise of more than 4 degrees Fahrenheit over the next century, with the prospect that crop harvest will fall 30%, leading to massive global hunger. The Kyoto Treaty has set only modest goals, a 5% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2012, a goal that 178 nations endorsed in Bonn last summer. In contrast, the Bush administration has rejected the Global Warming Treaty and only sent observers to the recent talks in Morocco. After further negotiation in Morocco, the other major industrial powers, the European Union, Russia and Japan, have consented to ratify the Kyoto Agreement. To get Russia on board, there were some big concessions made, including expanding emissions trading credits and giving Russia credit for vast forests that may act as a carbon sink and absorb greenhouse gases. If Europe, Russia and Japan all adopt the Kyoto Treaty, America, the biggest polluter of greenhouse gases, could do nothing to stop it. The Financial Times reports that a land resettlement conference in South Africa got off to a rocky start when the Landless People's Movement threatened to walk out because the government-run forum ignored major issues such as violence against farmers and farm labourers. The land reform meeting was set up to prevent the massive takeovers and violence targeted against white farmers in neighbouring Zimbabwe. Over the summer, there were several incidents, led by the Pan-Africanist Congress, of squatters taking over farms. The African National Congress-led government then agreed to the land reform meeting in Durban. In late November, Patrick Mojapelo, president of the Landless People's Movement, accused the South African government of downgrading the land reform effort, quote, which is dominated by academics and by technical discussion on a small section of the land question, unquote. At the moment, whites own 87% of the land in South Africa. Between 1960 and 1980, 3.5 million people were forced off their land by the racist apartheid regime. Now the ANC regime has promised to transfer 30% of farmland to blacks over the next 15 years. Still, landless advocates complain that the pace of land transfer is too slow. But the ANC government is moving ahead on legislation to hand over state-owned land in the former homeland zones to blacks currently living there and to grant them communal ownership. Last winter, maintenance workers got a shock at the Oconee nuclear station in South Carolina when they found white powder near several openings at the Unit 3 reactor vessel. The powder was not anthrax, but boron, which set off alarm bells among regulators because it meant that the cooling system had started to leak. After a 2-month investigation, the plant's owner, Duke Energy, told the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that metal on 9 nozzles in the reactor had cracked, and that 2 nozzles had broken apart, resulting in a leak of coolant. If undetected, a leak could have led to a major accident, like the 1979 incident at the Three Mile Island plant in Pennsylvania. Alarmed, the NRC quickly ordered safety inspections at 69 nuclear plants to look for cracks in their cooling systems. According to Mother Jones magazine, the nozzle cracks are another reminder that America's 103 nuclear power plants are aging and increasingly likely to break down. Yet the nuclear industry is not paying attention. It continues to run nuclear plants at full capacity in order to pay off big debt obligations and the high cost of storage of nuclear waste. This arrogance worries Michael Marriott of the activist Nuclear Information and Resource Service. He observed that the level of complacency that existed before Three Mile Island has returned. He warned there is the potential for much more serious consequences. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Three suicide bomb attacks in Jerusalem and Haifa on December 2nd took the lives of more than two dozen Israeli citizens and catapulted the Middle East into a dangerous new cycle of bloodshed. The Palestinian extremist group Hamas claimed responsibility for the bombings, saying they represented retaliation for the Israeli assassination of one of their top leaders. But Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and many in the United States placed the blame squarely on Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Israeli army reprisals were swift. F-16 jets, helicopters, and tanks were used in attacks against the Palestinian leader's headquarters in Jenin. Arafat's three helicopters were destroyed near his home, and bulldozers destroyed Gaza International Airport runways. Despite Arafat's orders arresting more than 100 Palestinians thought to be connected with the terror attacks, Israeli and U.S. officials demanded that he immediately act to dismantle Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other groups which have launched suicide bombings in the past. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Simmons College, who assesses the escalating Middle East violence and where it may lead if allowed to spin out of control.
I think everyone condemns the horrific events in Israel recently, but I think it's unwise to simply think that Arafat can bring these people under control, because the Palestinians, as you know, are terribly frustrated with the so-called peace process, which was never a peace process. And they have their lives are just more miserable than they have ever been. They are constantly under assault by Sharon and before him, Barak, settlements in their midst, and so forth and so on. Now, if Arafat simply clamps down on these people, which he's trying to do to meet American and Israeli demands, then the street is going to get very angry, because they see these people as the only resistance movement that's left for Palestinians to the oppressive Israeli occupation. And if he doesn't clamp down on them, then it gives Sharon, and encouraged by the U.S., more reason to get rid of Arafat. My sense and feeling is that Sharon is doing all of this intentionally. I would say that right from the beginning, we have to understand that the Zionist movement wanted all of Palestine. Now, we've gone through different phases, and I won't go through those. But once you get Sharon, you get the very clear picture of what the Zionists really want. They want all of Palestine without the Palestinians. Since that couldn't happen, in other words, in 67, Palestinians didn't flee for the most part, and they have them there, the next best thing is somehow to put them under an authority that would do the dirty work of the Israelis, while Israel still controlled most of the resources. And that hasn't quite worked, because the Palestinians are not obedient to simply being shoved into little areas and where they have no control over their lives. What Sharon wants to do is really to forget all about Oslo and even little cantons and even little Bantustans that Barak and others were willing to offer. He really wants to go down in history as having secured all of Palestine for Israel and with as few Palestinians as possible.
Where, in your opinion, is the violence between the Israelis and Palestinians likely to lead if allowed to spin out of control, Elaine?
I think it's a disaster for both peoples, but it's a bigger disaster for the Palestinians. I think that Sharon has been given the green light to do whatever he wants to do, and as you know, they have been restoring torture in Israel to try to extract all kinds of information from people who may or may not have information, and they may use torture even indiscriminately. But from the Israeli point of view, they think that they're going to make these people submit. From the Palestinian point of view, is they have nothing more to lose. They are willing to make peace if that peace says the occupation will leave. The occupation must leave. Now, my real sense, and it's also a frustration for those of us who see the both peoples who deserve to have a better life, is that the international community does not do anything. The United Nations is intimidated by the United States, which has always favored Israel, which has also been problematic for a number of the America's Arab Muslim allies. It's quite problematic for them. So I think if the UN or the international community in some form, a European Union or whatever, if they don't act soon to send in some sort of a peacekeeping force into the occupied territories, they must do this. They say they have to get the permission of Israel. Well, they didn't have to get the permission of lots of other places where they sent peacekeeping forces. They need to do that, and they need to work out a phased process to get the occupation out of there. The settlers would have to be resettled in Israel, and that would have to be worked out. And once they have a democratically elected Palestinian government, they would facilitate an international context for further negotiations on all outstanding issues to which international law applies, including the right of return. Now, that's pie in the sky, but I basically favor seeing the occupied territories put under a UN trusteeship and facilitated towards a viable Palestinian state with elections and eventually being able, with UN support, to be equal partners with Israel in negotiating all outstanding issues.
That was Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Simmons College in Boston. As the war in Afghanistan enters its third month, human rights groups are scrutinizing the conduct of forces fighting the fundamentalist Taliban government. A rebellion of prisoners held by the Northern Alliance near the city of Mazar-e-Sharif resulted in the deaths of some 450 Taliban soldiers, a number of guards, and an American CIA officer. Amnesty International is calling for an investigation into the circumstances surrounding the rebellion and the force used to put it down. Closer to home, Amnesty has expressed concern about the erosion of civil liberties resulting from some Bush administration anti-terrorist measures. These include the mass detention of immigrants, eavesdropping on conversations between some defendants and their attorneys, and the authorization of secret military tribunals for foreign nationals suspected of terrorism. Spain, which has recently arrested individuals that may be connected to the September 11th attacks, has refused to extradite suspects to face military trials in the U.S. The latest White House proposal to lift restrictions on FBI surveillance of domestic political and religious groups has stirred similar opposition. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kurt Goring, Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, who explains why his group and many other civil libertarians oppose government spying on civilians engaged in legal, political, and religious activity as a threat to basic human rights protections.
The government has the responsibility to take the measures that are necessary to deal with the special situation that we're facing, but these measures have to be taken in a way that respect fundamental human rights. And as soon as we begin to infringe on these basic liberties in our war on terror, then, you know, we begin to destroy, I think, the very values that make our society worth protecting. So I think the government has to tread very, very carefully here.
What are some of the lessons that we had learned or should have learned in terms of surveillance of people like Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, those who opposed the Vietnam War, and other political policies at the time? What are some of the concerns you have about another era where we are again letting loose the government agents to spy on Americans?
Well, if we return to a kind of FBI COINTEL program, which infiltrated groups in the past, Amnesty International was concerned then that people were being held on false charges. Sometimes information was manufactured, sometimes information was withheld from the courts. People ended up serving long, long prison terms, like Geronimo Pratt, on the basis of information with which the FBI had had manufactured or had withheld from the courts. And it was really impossible to know how widespread that was, but the amount that we do know was very, very disturbing. And after nearly 30 years, Geronimo Pratt was released without any of the charges against him being substantiated. And there are others in prison still today on the basis of FBI conduct and information, which is seriously questionable. And I have in mind the case of Leonard Peltier. And in that case, the Native American leader in Fort Leavenworth, who's being held on charges of murder. But again, in that case, the FBI knowingly used perjured testimony to obtain his extradition from Canada. And there's a whole range of questions about the case that the FBI has against Leonard Peltier.
Now, what is the reaction in Congress to all this, Kurt Goring? Are you encouraged that some people are recovering from the shock of the terrorist attacks to really look at the long-term implications for our Bill of Rights and civil liberties here in the United States for some of these measures coming out of the White House?
Well, there is there are some very strong voices of concern. Senator Leahy of Vermont, for example, is holding hearings. The Judiciary Committee is holding hearings this week on the tribunals and on the detainees. And he himself, Senator Leahy, that is, has indicated his discomfort with the secret trials and the possibility of executions, even summary executions, without the possibility of judicial review for foreign nationals. And you know, he is asking some very important questions at a very difficult time under difficult circumstances, but there aren't enough, like Senator Leahy, who are willing to ask the difficult questions that need to be asked, people who take the time to review the proposed legislation. You know, times of national emergency, and especially moments of nationalistic fervor, when a president has an approval rating of over 90%, you know, these are times when I think civil society and the role of the legislative branch has to be very, very vigilant in authorizing or rubber stamping what legislation is being proposed. They have a duty and a responsibility to look closely at and consider the perspectives of the legislation and the measures that are being handed down. And one of the alarming facts to us was that the Patriot Act, which was the first piece of legislation that the administration worked through Congress after September 11, that was passed with one dissenting vote, and many members of Congress in both the House and the Senate indicated they hadn't even read the legislation.
That was Kurt Goring, Senior Deputy Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. For more information, call them at 1-800-AMNESTY, or visit their website at www.amnesty.org. For the past dozen years, ever larger protests have taken place around November 16th at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. That date marks the anniversary of the 1989 murders in El Salvador of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter toward the end of that nation's U.S.-backed counterinsurgency war. A subsequent congressional investigation of the murders revealed that some of the perpetrators had ties to the U.S. Army School of the Americas, or SOA, a program based at Fort Benning that over the past 50 years has trained thousands of Latin American military leaders. A significant number of them have returned to their home countries to carry out terrorist attacks on their own people, including rape, kidnapping, and murder. In 1990, Catholic priest Roy Bourgeois founded an organization called SOA Watch, whose goal is to end U.S. funding for the School of the Americas. As a Maryknoll priest, Bourgeois has lived and worked in Latin America, seeing firsthand the results of the kind of terror inflicted by the graduates of the school. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended this year's protest in Georgia on November 17th and 18th and filed this report.
On Sunday, more than 10,000 people, the majority students, but also thousands of nuns, veterans, and others, marched in a solemn funeral procession to the gates of Fort Benning to remember the victims of human rights abuses committed by graduates of the school.
María Argueta, 35 años de edad, presente.
Child age unknown, son of Dominga Chavarria, presente.
Names were read from the stage of over 900 people killed in a single massacre in El Salvador. After September 11th, all military bases in the U.S. were put on high alert, and an 8-foot fence was built across the entrance to the base, which had been open during the previous 11 years of protests. The city of Columbus had sought an injunction to keep SOA Watch founder Father Roy Bourgeois and other leaders away from Fort Benning, citing the need for heightened security. But on Friday, as protesters were arriving in town, a federal judge ruled against the city's request. Judge Malin Faircloth was the same judge who last year sentenced 26 protesters to prison for crossing the line at Fort Benning. SOA Watch staffer Bill McNulty explained the significance of the ruling.
The judge, in rendering his decision, made some outstanding statements, basically saying that the School of the Americas Watch is protected by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that they have had Fort Benning Boulevard as a venue for free speech for 11 years, and it wouldn't be suitable to make a change in that at this stage of the game. He also stated that the military, if it couldn't handle matters on its own without the help of the Columbus authorities, was in a sorry state. And he further said that to justify all this heightened security, or at least heightened resistance to SOA Watch's efforts, on the basis of us being at war, that wasn't a good position to hold since we're not at war, since no act of Congress has brought us to war.
On Saturday, about 6,000 people gathered under sunny skies and 80-degree temperatures at a baseball stadium miles from the main gates at Fort Benning. They listened to Father Roy Bourgeois and others explain why the school, recently renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC, should be closed. Many people said they came specifically to oppose the attack on civil liberties posed by the threatened injunction. Singers galvanized the crowd with songs of sorrow and of hope. Enormous puppets depicting SOA victims and the SOA itself as a huge dragon brought the crowd to its feet. Many were already on their feet, dancing in the dust of the pitcher's mound. Margaret Knapke, recently released from a 3-month prison sentence for crossing the line at Fort Benning, explained why she did it.
I've been involved in Latin America solidarity work since the early 80s. I first woke up to what was happening in El Salvador and learned of my government's and my tax dollars' complicity and all that. And I've had an opportunity to go to Central America, first to Nicaragua and then repeatedly to El Salvador. So for me, it's not at all an abstract foreign policy issue. It's a very human issue. And I'm simply well aware that people are dying in that region every day as a direct consequence of U.S. foreign policy in general and of the School of the Americas in particular. And so it's simply not an option to ignore that fact.
On Sunday, the commander of WINSEC, Colonel Richard Downey, spoke to reporters from inside the newly erected fence. He said the Institute is committed to democracy and human rights and that the changes at the school go beyond the name.
We have a very different mission focus. Our focus is on challenges for the 21st century, not the past. It's the challenges of and the threats of the future. And what are those? It's peacekeeping, it's disaster relief, it's humanitarian civic action, it's counter-drug kinds of operations.
But one of the rally speakers, San Ho Tri, head of drug policy at the Institute for Policy Studies, put a different spin on the school's new direction.
A decade ago, the School of the Americas was justified as a way of fighting the Cold War in this hemisphere. Today, it's rationalized as a way of fighting the drug war. And tomorrow, I'm sure they'll use it as an excuse to fight the war on terror. But no matter how they rationalize the existence of this place, we will still rely on the same techniques of coercion and terror to control the civil populations of their own countries, who they were sworn to uphold and defend.
The protesters point out that Colombia has more personnel at the school than any other country, and that murders and other atrocities are being documented currently, so it's not a problem that lies only in the past. By the end of the day on November 18th, 80 people had been arrested when they made their way under, over, or around the fence at the entrance to Fort Benning. That night, 30 more were arrested as they sat singing in a circle in front of the gates. The 30 were charged with unlawful assembly, obstructing police, and blocking a road. The group practiced jail solidarity, refusing to give their names. They began a fast and demanded that their charges be reduced. As hundreds of faxes of support arrived at the courthouse the next day, those detained reached a plea bargain and were released on time served. Meanwhile, 14 of the first group of 80 arrested faced up to a year in federal prison on charges of trespass and resisting arrest. Organizers called this the most successful SOA protest yet and predicted the weekend's activities will build support for a bill in Congress that would close the SOA, now known as WNSEC. At Fort Benning, Georgia, for Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Contact the School of the Americas Watch by calling area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at www.soaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Monat, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.